Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder, and we are going to be talking about the Meyer case this afternoon. And boy, there's a lot of information here. Sometimes when you think you're really making progress and learning a lot, and then suddenly you just, you know, look at things again and you think, my goodness, I barely scratched the surface here. I finished reading The Psyche for the second time. I think I have a much better understanding of some things in here. And one of the issues I wanted to come back to was this whole idea of the boomerang thought. And then when a thought goes out, when you send a thought out, let's say it's a neutral, positive, healthy thought, it's sent out into the universe, so to speak, and it goes way, way out there into the expanses of the universe. And it eventually comes back to you, and it changes its polarity. But it doesn't change the kind of thought it is. For example, if it was a good, healthy, neutral, positive thought, it'll come back as a good, healthy, not neutral, positive thought. But it can change its polarity, meaning that if it was a good, healthy, neutral, positive thought with a slightly positive polarity, it'll come back as a good, healthy, neutral, positive thought with a slightly negative polarity. So that is real easy to get confused by. So again, a good thought comes back as a good thought, and a bad thought comes back, or a negative thought comes back as a negative thought. And there's an appendix in the book, The Psyche, on page 224 that kind of explains the boomerang effect in a little more detail. So far here, I'll read here, it says, so far so good. Let me read it here. It says, therefore, when it is said that radiated evil thoughts, worries, and unsatisfaction are hurled back with a boomerang-like effect, in which case they inevitably strike the thought emitter again with devastating force, which also occurs with good thoughts, however with only good thoughts, this is therefore to be rightly understood indeed as follows. According to nature, a radiated thought, whether positive or negative, will be hurled back exactly as it was set out, only very immensely strengthened. So as it was sent out, if it was a good, healthy thought, it'll come back as a good, healthy thought, but it'll come back stronger. So far, so good thoughts that are sent out are thrust back exactly as they were sent out and intensified. So only the polarity is changed. Good thoughts in their substance are coming back as good thoughts in their substance. But during their flight radiation, their polarity has changed to the opposite. This then gives and enables new food stuff for the consciousness to work with. So a negative, unhealthy thought is sent out and returns as a positive, unhealthy thought. If you could imagine such a thing. But due to the fact that it returns as a positive polarity, thought power, it creates new food stuff, so to speak, to help our evolution. So hopefully that puts a little bit of light on an interesting subject there, the boomerang effect. So – Let me read here again here from the book, The Psyche. He slash she should not be good and submissive in the form which the religions teach, because this way brings only the consciousness-based and bodily ruin. The creation itself demands of the spirit and of the consciousness to be positive and negative and thereby equalized. Therefore, already the irrational teachings of the religions are thereby recognizable and reveal that they are only destructive machinations of primitive thinking human beings, the work of a primitive power hunger and delusion and charlatanery. It is quite right that in certain ways specific thoughts come back identically, simply as they were sent out, in the sense that positive comes back as effective positive. So then love can thus be harvested for love, and hatred will be harvested as hatred. So in any case, there is some very, very profound material here in the Might of Thoughts. And I wanted to talk today also about the three golden rules. And they are this: to cultivate your wish dreams that we've been talking about. So a wish dream is kind of a mental image, a picture, something that you would like to have happen. But you think of it as it is occurring. So when you think of a wish dream, you're thinking of it in the present tense, and you're imagining it as something happening. It could be real simple. It could be a sunny day, your pet's playing outside and rolling around in the grass, or something, whatever is pleasant for you. So that will stop any negative thought patterns that you're having, and by putting in that neutral positive. So, but you should never have a wish dream that's about something that will be in the future. So, okay. Let me read a little bit here what it says about the wish dream here. It says, in order to learn neutral positive thinking, it is only necessary to turn in thoughts immediately to this old or new wishful dream, and to indulge in it. And we're told to indulge in it with great fantasy. And let those thoughts will begin to influence the thinking. And this is the way to break out of that habit of worry or vexation or negative thoughts that are overwhelming. And we all get in that state sometimes. So the wishful dream, the fantasy, whatever it is, don't think of it, then never, ever, ever think of it in uncertain terms. Don't ever think of it about as something that's going to happen. No, think of it as something that is happening. And let that wish dream, let that image develop too. In other words, it says here, build gigantic castles in the sky and indulge. And all that is able to please the senses, happiness, love, beauty, understanding, everything which uplifts the heart and the feelings. There are no set limits on this fantasy. So, and this is a healthy fantasy, something that would be reasonable and healthy, and use imagery, mental imagery, when you're thinking about this. Think about, I like to think about my cats playing and rolling around on the ground out in the sun, or me sitting out with them and them sitting in my lap. Something which neutralizes any repeating negative worry and vexation kind of thoughts. Let me continue here. In the beginning, it will take an immense amount of effort to concentrate on this wishful dream, because the negative thoughts The negative thought world constantly shoots in morale-killing arrows. Have you ever noticed that? The negative thought world, we all have a negative thought world. That's very interesting. And I think they come out of the subconscious. Those arrows, those negative thoughts that come out of the subconscious and they're morale-killing. Have you ever noticed that? It's like we always have some aspect of our subconscious, of our hidden self, that seems to be at times attacking us. Let me continue here. Unceasingly, the subconsciousness tries to push the rampant negative goods of thoughts into the foreground, through which a concentration on the wishful dream can be brought about, but only with great struggle. So if you're in this struggle where a negative thought's winning the battle, your wish dream, you're going to have trouble. It's going to be a struggle to get the wish dream there. It's not always a struggle, though. It doesn't always have to be. Nevertheless, however, over and over again, every thought must be directed to the wishful dream until the negative advancement of the subconscious slowly subsides. So we want to stop the advancement of the subconscious, because it's very interesting. Earlier in the book here, he was saying that if you have any doubt, and like if you're thinking in terms of, oh, this could happen or this might happen, your subconscious will immediately turn that into something like, oh, this won't happen or this can't happen. So you have to be absolutely positive. And when you're absolutely positive, you're also absolutely logical. And in order to gain control of your thoughts, you have to learn to be absolutely logical. Okay. Again, it says, however, over and over again, every thought must be directed to the wishful dream until the negative advancement of the subconscious slowly subsides. Okay, so that's, again, and we'll cover this again. I'm sure we're going to need to cover this a lot, because this is part of the spiritual teachings that I think is real practical. It's real down to earth, and it's where the rubber meets the road. Controlling your thoughts and breaking that repeating negative thought that is like the weeds taking over your garden, because your garden, your consciousness is much like a garden. You got to pull those weeds out. Second golden rule, first golden rule was the wishful dream and getting the mastering of the wishful dream. The second golden rule is pretty simple. And he literally says, smiling and forcing yourself to smile, even in a difficult situation. Forcing yourself to smile and be cheerful in a difficult situation. That's the second golden rule. And the third one is you should keep your head high and not let it hang down, and look straight forward and look someone in the eye and do not lower your head. So these golden rules will help you keep in a neutral, positive way of thinking. Now here's 10 recommendations also for these golden rules. First of all, spend a lot of time outdoors as much as you can. Go on long walks. Get out into the forest and into nature. And Billy recommends shouting on your long. I haven't done that yet. Or also singing while you're walking. I've done that a little bit. That also can be good as well. Trying to walk barefoot. When you're on a long walk, halfway through the walk, take a break, sit down. I did that today. And focus, if you can, then on your wishful dream. Listen and watch nature and observe things. Anyway, there are, reflect on your deeds and your speech. Always keep people's, if someone's entrusted you with the confidence, keep that to yourself. Speak slowly and deliberately. And number 10, absolutely and honestly, be absolutely honest and correct towards oneself and towards fellow human beings. So So those are the 10 recommendations. So this is a little different today. This show is a little different. I must say that. I wanted to just briefly go over a few things about the creation. It's the most primal, immense, and greatest power that you can imagine. It's immeasurable in its wisdom. One thing that the creation does is it creates, and I've never heard it put this way before, new spirit clusters. Human spirits, and it refers to them in clusters. And after these human spirits go through the countless rebirths, they come back to the creation, and it absolutely fulfills itself when these spirit forms rejoin with creation after these millions of years of reincarnation. Another interesting statement here: the more humanly and worldly a human being thinks and acts, the more underdeveloped he/she is in the spirit and in the consciousness. Because worldly and human thinking means that a human being stands at a primary and still much in need of progress stage of spiritual consciousness-based evolution. In general, the mass of humankind is quite consciously kept at this stage by authorities and governments. I've never heard Billy quite say it so bluntly like this. Partly because they themselves are not instructed any better, but also partly because through it the human being can become enslaved and suppressed to the greatest measure. The most terrible machinations in relation to this are practiced by the religions who undermine the self-confidence of human beings and by cunning and treachery drive them into a false submissiveness before an imaginary God. Again, creation is the superintelligence that created our universe. The German refers to it as a Wesenheiten, meaning that it functions kind of robotically, automatically. It really doesn't have a personality. It's hard for us to imagine that. It, however, radiates love. The incredible splendor of nature is the visible expression of this the love of creation. So it's nothing like the God that's depicted in our religions, in our scriptures. In fact, the word God means literally in the German language, wisdom king. And the prophet Emmanuel said, God is a human being like every other human being. However, above God stands the creation. Because the creation alone is the immeasurable secret. So creation does not demand prayer, worship, or any similar kind of activity. Now we talked a little bit about prayer and how what prayer is. Prayer comes out from our consciousness and comes back to the innermost self. So if you pray to creation, you actually end up praying to your own spirit, which is a part of creation. Creation is truly the most magnificent, which stands above all life, and it alone is absolutely worthy enough to be respected, honored, and recognized by the human beings as creation. The worship and veneration of a God, however, as the religions are able to offer, is contrary to nature and false. Whosoever knows this and still acts falsely contravenes against the creational laws and hinders his/her way of evolution to the consciousness space and the spiritual relative absolute fulfillment. Okay. So who is Edward Albert Meyer? Edward Albert Meyer is a man in his late 70s. He lives in a tiny mountain village in Switzerland called Hinterschmidruti. His extraterrestrial contact started back in 1945 when he first met with an extraterrestrial man named Spoth. Now, Spoth at that time was about 900 years old. And Billy was taken up into his ship. A device was placed on Billy's head that would open up the wisdom of his predecessor personalities, which are immense. Because the spirit form in the young boy, Edward Albert Meyer, was 9.6 billion years old. Now, that's kind of hard for us to wrap our minds around because our Earth is only 5 billion years old. And humanity developed on the Earth, Homo sapiens, about 9 to 12 million years ago. Before that time, we had people visiting here on the Earth. The travelers from Lyra Vega came here about 22 million years ago. And exactly what happened during that original trip here, I do not know. I don't have all that information yet. But let me quickly talk about something here along those lines that we've been talking about a bit. And that would be that's odd. Oh, my bad. I wanted to cover a little bit of the material that we talked about last time. It talks about some of the extraterrestrials that visited here on Earth. About 16 million years ago, a fleet from the Lyra system discovered yellow races on the planet Kudra. This is stretching your mind a little bit, stretching my mind. Our galaxy, which is incredibly immense, it has 200 or 300 billion stars in it, and a central sun, which I guess is kind of the anchor which everything kind of spins around. On the other side of that central sun is a planet called Kudra, and it's the place where the yellow oriental races evolved. And evidently, 16 million years ago, which was before there was any kind of Homo sapiens on the Earth, a fleet from Lyra Vega traveled to Kudra on the other side of the Milky Way galaxy. And these people that were there were called the Kintan and the Nipah races, the Oriental races. And those ships from Lyra Vega brought about 4,000 of these Oriental peoples back to a planet called Lazon, and there was actually an alliance of planets, this Lazon alliance, in the Lyra Vega system. So these people, these 4,000 Oriental people, were spread out on these five different planets, and they populated these planets. And millions of years passed, and these Kintan and Nipah races, there were wars, and these people started to struggle. So about 38,000 people left those five planets and entered into nine spaceships, and they traveled to Earth. And they settled here on Earth between 6 and 7 million years ago in the northeastern corner of this large landmass that appeared in a global ocean at the time. However, their ships deteriorated because of our atmosphere. And that's interesting because the wedding cake ship had the same problem. You know, we just don't think of our atmosphere as dangerous like that. I mean, but things do rust, so that should be a kind of a wake-up call, I guess. Anyway, so these people came to the Earth, these Oriental races, about 6 to 7 million years ago, and they ended up dying on Earth, okay? The people on Kudra that were still there, they had this massive population explosion. And this gets really interesting because they left those planets at Kudra in millions of ships. Now, just trying to wrap your mind around that, I can't. Millions of ships carrying billions of people, and they were trying to find a new home. While things didn't go that well, and they became lost and spent a lot of time in these ships, and people started getting sick, and there were diseases that were passed, and literally billions of people died on these ships. And only 418,000 made it to the Lyra system. So they were traveling from Kudra to the Lyra system. Well, and they found a planet called Nisan, and this was about 2.4 million years ago. And that 418,000 people, I guess, survived and started to populate this planet called Nisan. Well, about 26,000 years ago, people also came here from Kudra and settled in China and Japan. And that's how the Japanese and the Chinese races got here. That's an interesting story. I certainly think so. Now, on the topic of extraterrestrials here on the Earth, we've also had bases here on the Earth. And we had bases in North America and bases in Asia and a base in Switzerland. It was here for 350 years. There was also an extraterrestrial base in an area called Hyperborea. I shouldn't say that. These people that originally lived in Hyperborea, which was first located in the North Pole region, eventually, after the fall of Atlantis and Lemuria, and after a great, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, these people moved within Mount Shasta in Northern California, where there was a small city that had 700 people. And they were called the Hyperboreans. They were actually a white race with blonde hair, and they were the leftover descendants of an extraterrestrial race that lived on the Earth. They have these golden-colored spherical spacecraft that can be seen coming out of Mount Shasta. And at times, they're also seen coming out of other locations like Mount Mammoth. And the Hyperboreans at times get visits from extraterrestrials who come here from other worlds. The Hyperboreans also carry beam weapons that sometimes can be used to stun Earth humans that get a little too close to their home there in Mount Shasta. They also had bases deep underground in the Aleutian Islands in Alaska. And the Hyperboreans have been on the Earth for about 180 to 190,000 years. Now, if that time frame is correct, that means they were here actually before Atlantis and Lemuria, the cities were built. And these Hyperboreans also, there was an Ishwish that came from these Hyperboreans, a king of wisdom, who helped Noah, who told Noah about the great flood that would come and helped Noah in terms of instruction to build this great ark. And I don't know if you remember Noah Kadnesser. He was about 9 feet tall, 3 meters and 10 centimeters, over 10 feet tall. And he was commissioned to build this ark by this king of wisdom who came from the Hyperboreans. So these Hyperboreans have been on the earth about 180,000 to 190,000 years. There was also a group on the earth with they had an undersea base. And they were called the Hasters. And they came from another galaxy, very, very far away. And they were closer to our level of evolution. And they were actually brought here by the Plearon themselves. And these inhabitants, these Hasters, as they're called, could stay within close proximity of an Earth people there for like 17 hours before they would start to feel negative effects from our vibrations. That's one of the big differences, because our vibrations are not the same as many of these higher evolved peoples. And I've talked about that. Their base, their station, was created in the depths of the North Sea. So it's very interesting what's happened here on the Earth. It's unfortunate in 1995, almost all of these extraterrestrials left. We still don't know why. Now, I don't think all of them left, though, because in Contact 215, it talks about when things get really, really bad, there will be some extraterrestrial intervention, I think, that will help us. So anyway, I know sometimes I do repeat this stuff a lot. To me, it always feels like I'm learning more detail and getting a clearer picture of all this information. We've talked about Atlantis and Lemuria before. And in Contact 70, which actually occurred in 1977, January 6th, Semyase really talked about a lot of this stuff. And in Contact Report 59, which I think you can only get on my site right now, is the only one that I'm aware of on the internet. And if you go to exopoliticsohio.us, that's correct. And you go to my Billy Meyer, go down to the tab called Various at the very top. Google Ohio Exopolitics. The website will come up, exopoliticsohio.us. There'll be a button there called Various. If you'll go down in there to Contact 59, you'll get Wendell Stevens' unauthorized translation of the 59th Contact, which goes into tremendous detail on the Atlantis and Lemuria stuff. And I'll talk about it a little bit today. It also talks about Pelagon, when Pelagon came to the Earth. I had this text came off of photocopied pages, and there's software now that can pull the text off of these photocopies, and it does a pretty good job. I had to just go in by hand and clear up a few little errors here and there. So the Atlant came here about 130,000 years ago. And his wife Caryatide came here. And they built Greater Atlantis and smaller Atlantis. There was a island continent in the area of the Atlantic Ocean between South America and Africa, I believe, at that time. Probably close to the equator, I'm guessing. And it wasn't long before you could see the beautiful architecture of these kings of wisdom. Atlant was a man of obvious Lyran descent. He had broad shoulders, white pasty skin. His wife was a king of wisdom, a queen of wisdom, excuse me, an Ishrish. So these were very advanced human beings in the final stages of evolution. I shouldn't say in the final stages of evolution. The final stages of having a physical body. We incarnate into a physical body for about 42 million years before we go into a half spiritual, half physical state. So another man came here and who built the cities of Mu, which was in the area of the Gobi Desert. Underground, there was Agartha Alpha and Agartha Beta, and they were connected by these underground tunnels. And the two cities, they existed for thousands of years in a very positive state. Now, there was another king of wisdom, an Ishwish, who came here about 113,000 years ago. He was a very bestial man. They called him Eris the Barbarian. He had an extraordinarily bestial mind, a very overpowering force to his material consciousness. And he had scientists working under them, about 200 scientists working under them. And they settled north of what is known as America now. They first came into Hyperborea, what I was talking about earlier, which is actually near our North Pole. And Eris took over Hyperborea. His son, Eris II, took over India and Pakistan. Now, under Eris was a scientist by the name of Semyasa. Semyasa, according to Meyer information, this gets very wild, is an earlier, if I'm correct here, from my memory, an earlier incarnation of the same spirit form that's now in Quetzal, one of Billy's contacts. So Semyasa was the father of the person that we call Adam today. In other words, Semyasa violated one of the rules of these Atlanteans because they were not supposed to interact sexually with the native earth humans. There were some native earth humans here that some of them evolved on the earth. Other ones were, how can I say this? We've had extraterrestrial groups on the earth that would die on the earth for various reasons. And they intermingled with some of the native earth people. So there were, it's a complicated story. But anyway, Semyasa mated with one of these Evas, they're called, and had an offspring they called Adam. This enraged Eris, by the way. And Adam was 16 feet tall. He was white skin. A big individual by our standards. Again, Eris had 200 high-grade scientists with him, and he made these people sub-leaders. And his group fell upon the earth, robbing, murdering, taking possession of land. And again, they conquered the northern regions, which was very good climate at that time. Lots of, you could get orange trees and other, probably pineapples and all these kinds of fruit trees that were growing in the northern regions. That was before the earth shifted on its axis. You see, the earth shifted on its axis because of this great war in the ancient, ancient past. Eris, after about 500 years, he became kind of old and weak. But he had stirred up enough dissension between Atlantis and Lemuria that they had this great war that occurred between them. Now, these are extraterrestrial groups on the Earth here. And the power of these two cities are an incredible, they had an incredible ability. For example, Greater Atlantis alone had an army of about 4.83 million people. They were equipped with these small fighter beam ships. The government of Atlantis had a giant fleet of 123,000, these destroyer ships. Anyway, they attacked Mu and melted the city to the ground. Some of the people escaped from Mu, some of the scientists. And they discovered powers which made it possible for them to convert small planets, asteroids, into all-destroying cosmic bombs. So what they went and did, they flew their beam ships into cosmic space, into the ring of asteroids that exist outside the orbit of Mars. Those asteroids are the remnants of the destroyed planet Melona. In the very, very ancient past in our solar system, there were three planets that supported life: Earth, Mars, and Melona. Melona was destroyed when the inhabitants of the planet directed an ocean into a volcano. So these Lemurians went out and grabbed one of these asteroids, a planetoid, several kilometers in diameter. And they used atomic and electromagnetic energies to push this asteroid out of its orbit and bring it back as a great weapon. They aimed it at Atlantis. So when these people saw this thing coming into the atmosphere, it was a horrific sight. Only some of the leaders managed to escape. And when the asteroid came into the atmosphere of Earth, it made this horrible sound. It was a monstrous thing when they saw this. It looked like a falling star. And the people that stared at this thing, they stared at it in shock. And this thing, it glowed like a supernova, and it generated a heat of over 34,000 degrees. And it exploded some over 100 meters above the Earth, 100 kilometers, excuse me. And it broke into these larger and smaller meteorites, which landed all over the Earth. And this huge explosion and thunder rolled all over the globe. Two great parts of the exploding planetoid crashed like titanic fists into the Atlantic Ocean and slammed into the crust of the Atlantic Ocean. And what it says here in the contact, it seemed like the Earth was going to die. A tremendous situation. Anyway, there was a gigantic tidal wave from these two gigantic parts of this asteroid slamming into the Atlantic Ocean, and the island kingdom of Atlantis was submerged below the raging waters of the Atlantic Ocean. It didn't leave behind one living creature. The capital of Atlantis, which was constructed in the form of a beam ship, was rent into several pieces, and it also went underground. Now, this was supposed to have occurred 11,500 years ago. So, the great story of Atlantis and Lemuria, this is it, folks. This is what occurred 11,500 years ago. And we are the society that's just crawling out of the rubble. We don't know who we are. We don't know where we come from. We don't know what the rest of the universe is like. We're inundated with religions that cause confusion. So we are a people that are ill in our consciousness. And we're in a total state of disorientation. And that's why I gravitate to the Meyer material, because it answers all the big questions in life. Who are we? Where do we come from? What's the purpose of our life? What are the other civilizations in our Milky Way galaxy like? You know, what happens after we die? So all these very, very profound questions are answered by the Meyer case. And I certainly kind of went off on a tangent there about Atlantis and Lemuria. But it's good to have the answers to these questions that we have. But I started talking about Billy and about his spirit form. And about the human spirit. Because we all have a human spirit. It's located in our superior colliculus. It is no bigger than the head of a pin. And it radiates an energy which goes throughout our entire body. It causes our heart to beat. And that's when the evolution of our consciousness starts, is when the spirit form goes in the superior colliculus. And our consciousness comes in also. And our subconsciousness has the memories of all the predecessor personalities. But, you know, I learned something today which I'm trying to also process, because we get impulses from our predecessor personalities, but I don't think we necessarily get memories per se. We get information from the storage banks about our predecessor personalities if we reach a certain level of evolvement. And that's one of the ways that Billy has gotten information from his predecessor personalities. One of those predecessor personalities started on Earth as a man named Henok, with a K, H-E-N-O-K, Henok, who came here about 389,000 years ago, must have been one of the original Lyrians. That was 389,000 years ago. This spirit form has incarnated on the earth, as you know, as Enoch, Elijah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Emmanuel, and Muhammad. Now, the one of the incarnations that we call Enoch was actually named Henoch, and I believe there were three Henochs, H-E-N-O-C-H. That's not the Henoch I was just talking about, which was H-E-N-O-K. The Nokodamian spirit form is 9.6 billion years old. Now, can you imagine what it must feel like to have a spirit form of that age and to be incarnated on a world? The most human spirits on the earth are between 4 and 5 million years old. There are extraterrestrial human spirits here on the earth that are 8 to 12 million years old. There are 218.9 million spirit forms here on the earth that are of extraterrestrial origination. So that means they came here on the ship and they died on the earth and they entered into the reincarnational patterns of the earth. We incarnate into a physical body for 42 million years. And we go up through five different stages of evolution. We start out primitive. Then we go into the stage we are now here on Earth, the rational life. We go into intelligent life, which we're not there yet. And then we go into a stage where it's called real life. And we get great abilities in terms of genetic engineering at this point. Now, at that time, we're able to create sentient life. And this is a very disturbing thing for religions, because this is supposed to be something only that the quote-unquote God can do. But the Pleiaren have within their ship a sentient intelligence. Their central computer on their ship is a sentient intelligence. That means Semyase could communicate with it telepathically. It was self-aware. It was truly a living being with a metallic hull. That's a shocker. In other words, personal responsibility really is the way of the universe. And I think that's probably the most shocking aspect of many of the Meyer things. Stage five is even a higher level of development, and that's the final stage where we no longer have a physical body. Or excuse me, that's just before we lose a physical body. That's the King of Wisdom. And at that stage, we develop great consciousness abilities, great consciousness powers. We're able to look into the future, look into the past, do telekinesis, that means moving things with our minds. Teleportation, some people will be able to literally go from one place to the next, move their bodies. Telepathy, these were what the King of Wisdoms were able to do, amazing things beyond our wildest imaginations. At stage, if we step back to stage four, that's where we become true space travelers. We jump across the universe with no time passing. So you can see how the religions, when they saw people here with these kinds of abilities, they would attach terms like God to them. They would attach terms like demons and devil. Can you imagine how disturbing to their consciousness this was to see these advanced peoples and their abilities? Completely mind-boggling, their abilities. So it's really, in some ways, if you're a space-traveling society, you really have to live up to a high level of ethics. Because when you go into a less advanced society, you can completely upset their evolution just by being who you are. And this is not a good thing. It can cause a lot of damage. And I think that's what's happened here on the Earth. On top of that, we've had civilizations which have risen and fallen. So we have the physical evidence of the more advanced societies here on Earth with things like the Great Pyramid and these other megalithic and monolithic structures all over the Earth. Like in Tiwanaku, and some of the structures down there in Bolivia. Pumapunku and Machu Picchu. And some of these ancient structures, which were really probably built by these ancient civilizations, which knew things that we don't even have the slightest clue of yet. So we look at these ancient structures and we just, you know, we go into a state of stupefaction and we make up little stories to try to understand how they could have possibly been built. But the truth of the matter is, the people that designed these structures and knew these building techniques were from other star systems. Now they either wandered off and left, or they destroyed themselves in these great wars, or they just died and entered into the reincarnational patterns of Earth. But now we are a people who we don't know who we are. We don't know where we come from. We really don't know the purpose of our life anymore. But the purpose of our life is to gather wisdom, and the purpose of our life is to grow to these higher consciousness evolution places, to go through all these seven stages of evolution, to merge back with creation. Remember, wisdom is a kind of knowledge that produces energy. And the energy associated with wisdom helps the whole creation to evolve. And your thoughts radiate out from you, and they affect plants and animals and people. So steer your thoughts, nurture your thoughts, clarify your thoughts, because good thoughts lead to good feelings. Good feelings lead to good habits. Good habits leads to good circumstances in your life. And you can control, and you will control, and you are, if you're practicing these principles, controlling the circumstances of your life. You are the master of the circumstances of your life, and you're a master of your own evolution. And you're responsible for your own evolution. And we have such a monstrous power in our thoughts that correct thinking will continually bring into fruition everything that we think and everything that we desire. Just make sure those thoughts are healthy, that they're neutral positive, because when they go out into the vastness of the universe, they're going to come back to you strengthened. And a healthy thought will come back to you as a healthy thought. But a negative thought will come back to you as a strengthened negative thought. So it's very important to take the responsibility to control your thoughts. And controlling your thoughts is one of the keys to the evolution of your consciousness and the keys to happiness in life. Well, I know I was kind of all over the place today, but I hope you enjoyed the show, and it's also good to recap some of these information. But we'll talk to you again next week. You're listening to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. Have a good day.